It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, co-editors at Eat the Steak. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
How was your holiday? Is it all right?
I managed to successfully avoid tofurkey for another year. That was a good thing.
I didn't avoid actually eating a piece of three different pies, one piece each of three different pies. So I thought it would have taken superhuman effort not to try all three, but
so we're stuffed. That's basically
yeah.
All right.
Turkey.
Yeah. Well, that would explain why you have toothpicks in your mouths. So let's. We're coming up on a very important anniversary this week.
Well, yeah, it depends on who you talk to, but as to how important they think it is or how much they want to remember it. But it is the fifth anniversary this week of the WTO protests here in Seattle, and time for. The WTO itself has been in the news a little bit. We'll talk about that in a minute, but. The anniversary of the protests is really a time to reflect on what an amazing accomplishment those protests were for Seattle and for people in this area and this region who were probably at least half of the protesters who were out on the streets on N30 back in 1999. And if you look at what has happened since then, it has it really served as a catalyst, not so much nationally. The anti-globalization movement nationally, it really got to the point where the WTO protests nationally brought the sort of trade issues into the conversation. It became something that was actually conflicted in sort of the public dialogue. But it hasn't really gotten any farther than that. You don't have very many politicians who have taken up the fair trade banner. We saw that certainly in the presidential elections where John Kerry and George Bush were both very much pro-globalization. And we see that with the bipartisan leadership of both parties, that they're still very much on the bandwagon for that.
Kerry had some, I think, kind of vague language about helping workers, but not a whole lot of specifics.
Yeah, and then the irony, of course, is that he went and lost Ohio.
which has had very high unemployment.
Yeah, but if you look at the campaign overall, the only candidates that really talked about that at all were Richard Gephardt and Kucinich, and neither of their campaigns did very well.
Well, and Nader did as well.
And Nader did as well, right? Yeah. I was thinking more of the Democrats.
More among the Democrats,
In terms of the leadership of the country, it really hasn't penetrated to that level, but it has penetrated to that level in much of the rest of the world, particularly South America, where you have of the 13 or 14 countries there, almost all of them now have leaderships or governments that are very critical of the what is called the Washington Consensus, the neoliberal trade assumptions of that underlie the WTO and International Monetary Fund and World Bank, those institutions. Argentina and Brazil, in particular, have sort of led the bloc that have helped bring the WTO expansion talks to a standstill in Cancun last year and in Qatar and Seattle before that. That emerging bloc took its inspiration directly from what happened in the streets of Seattle, and we've seen that also with the stalling of the FTAA talks in Miami about a year ago this time. We've seen it with the switch in tactics with the U.S. government, where they've gone from relying on the WTO and these sort of multilateral institutions to trying to do bilateral and regional agreements like CAFTA, the Central American Free Trade Agreement. And they've had individual bilateral negotiations with Singapore and a couple of other isolated countries like that, Chile. But we haven't seen the progress that would have been predicted 5 years ago, and the reason for that is very much Seattle, what happened here. So it's worth commemorating. We were talking about trying to find where the protest was this year, because we know one's being organized. Did not see it in Gene Buskin's calendar this morning looking for it. I know Bob Barnes has been organizing and applying for permits for it, and that something will be happening probably this coming Tuesday, the November 30th. But look for that in Gene Buskin's calendar, and if anybody knows what that is, if they can email us.
Can email us here at the station up till 9 o'clock at dj@kexp.org, and we'll get that info out.
We'll get it on the air before the end of the show.
Or your money fully refunded.
Yes.
So, related to the WTO, there's been an article in the paper yesterday or today about a fine.
Yeah, the United States has been fined $150 million by primarily the European Union and Japan, but also a number of other countries, Canada, India, Mexico, Brazil, brought a suit based upon an anti-dumping law.
And this was a WTO decision, right?
This was a World Trade Organization decision, that's right, that... once again, it's not the largest settlement that's been levied against the United States in the last couple of years. There have been a couple of others that have been larger. Again, very much the United States practices protectionist policies, and then tries to it's the old exclusionary or exclusivity clause where the United States tries to make the rules for everybody else and then break the rules itself. This is something that's been going on routinely with trade law and international norms in the world. What is significant about this fine is that it was brought by so many different countries, that a lot of different countries are now challenging the United States and challenging its practices. And this is something that has not happened in the past. Again, I think obviously it predated the elections, but the belligerence of the Bush administration and its sort of inability to smooth the diplomatic waters with other countries is I think contributed a lot to other countries being willing to prosecute under the rules of the WTO.
Yeah, and when the Bush administration refuses to negotiate with anybody for anything and engage in any kind of diplomacy, it makes it hard for them to go to these countries and say, give up your lawsuit at the WTO and we will give you X in return. When the Bush administration can't even engage in that kind of negotiation, then you know there's a real problem.
All right.
Yeah, and it really augurs poorly that we've got an administration coming into the State Department in terms of Condoleezza Rice replacing Colin Powell that is considered more hardline, less willing to negotiate, less willing to engage in diplomacy than its predecessor. It's going to be a long 4 years.
Yeah, and ironically, might spell the doom of the WTO.
Yeah,
eventually.
So the Seattle protesters will have won out.
Hmm. All right, anything else on that?
No, that's enough for now.
Moving along to...
happy anniversary.
The international news. Boy, you have electoral problems here in the U.S. and it doesn't make the papers, but when it's in another country, it's front page news. The Ukraine is making a lot of headlines.
Well, and when you have electoral problems in other countries, people pour out into the streets and fill the plazas and demand new elections, and it doesn't happen in this country either. Funny thing. We've got the two victors in the Ukraine, Viktor Yanukovych and Viktor Yushchenko. We were practicing the names before we went on the air.
Because they can be confusing.
They can be confusing, the two victors. Yushchenko is the pro-Western candidate. Yanukovych is the Russian sympathizer. This in a country that is traditionally within the Russian sphere of influence, and that Russia has been very much concerned over the past several years. Will join NATO. Will join the West. Will become more of a trading partner with the West and less a trading partner with Russia, which has implications for everything from security and weapons to agricultural and trade policies and the economies of Russia as well as the Ukraine.
The vast mining resources in the Ukraine that Russia relies on.
And Russia also relies on the Ukrainian ports in the Black Sea to have access to international waters, because the Russian ports in the Arctic, of course, are frozen much of the year. So Russia is eyeing this standoff very cautiously, and in the last day or so, it's starting to look like the way out of this standoff will be some sort of a revote, which again is a concept that nobody's been talking about here in the United States, but it's a sort of thing where in the Ukraine there is such passion around this because you have an entire section of the country in the east where people are more tend to speak Russian or ethnically Russian, where they see the emergence of Yushchenko as sort of a threat to their autonomy. In fact, they're talking a little bit about the possibility of secession if Yushchenko assumes power. Whereas in the west part of the country, it's more European, looking toward Yushchenko as a U.S. born wife, and they're not, it's much more nationalist. They're not as inclined to look toward Russia. I almost said the Soviet Union, but you have much more of a passion for how this will resolve itself. You have hundreds of thousands of people literally camping in freezing weather in Kiev, the capital, trying to have some sort of a resolution to this crisis, and you just don't see that kind of engagement here in the United States. It just doesn't exist.
All right. Although I was speaking of in the United States, with the in Ohio, they're pushing for the Greens and the Libertarian Party are pushing for a recount, and I guess people just keep their fingers crossed on when that goes through.
Now the General Accounting Office is getting into the act. They decided that they would review some of the voting irregularities that occurred during this last election, particularly with electronic voting machines in various places around the country. Now the GAO, the General Accounting Office, is Congress's watchdog arm, and they have said that the result of their investigation is not going to change the results of the election, but it might change the way electronic voting machines and the way the count is done in a lot of places around the country. So keep your eye out for that, too.
Yeah, the momentum for any kind of reform of these electronic voting machines has to be generated right around the elections. If it's not going to happen now, it's not going to happen before the elections in 2006. I mean, that's just the reality. So, push for it to happen now. Try and stay on that bandwagon.
Right. I know a lot of that, the funding for that came from various people, again, both the Greens and the Libertarians paying for that. But I know the Greens have, like, on their website, David Cobb's website, a way for people to contribute, an amount for the recount efforts. So, and I contacted their people there, and they assured me that any money raised on that would go towards recounting and not towards any, Green Party building or,
And these things need to happen in order for there to be a real challenge to the use of the electronic voting machines and the way that they're not being safe, made a safe way to vote. I think in order to really challenge that, people need to be pushing for these recounts that show the errors and what the errors are and what the error rate is.
Yeah, and we're seeing that here in the governor's race also, where the margin between Dino Rossi and Christine Gregoire is so razor thin. It's, 46 votes now, I
42
think.
Votes,
42
I think.
Votes that Rossi is ahead by. They're going to a hand recount, and, a hand recount is actually less reliable than a computer recount. It's less accurate, but at the same time, it might show that in the parts of the state where there are these electronic touchscreens machines, that they're not necessarily reliable either, and we need to learn more about that, because we don't have any way to audit those results right now, and we need to have a way to do that.
Yeah, and it'll bring up these other issues too of ballots that are rejected for various reasons, and counties like Franklin County, where you had more ballots than you had registered voters. Things like that will come to light, and there'll be questions resolved about some of those issues, and perhaps we'll be able to understand how that happened on Election Day in the first count. So I think a recount has some value, and I also think it's just kind of a fun and interesting process. A lot of people are frustrated by it, but I see it as another example of real democracy takes time. It's not something you can have in 24 hours.
Yeah, or 3 hours, as the networks would prefer.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like the very process of democracy, working that out. And it seems like that everyone should be concerned with that and move forward with that happening. So, All right. Well, speaking of elections, I know that's going to be one of the things that you're going to be talking about in this week in Iraq.
Yeah, first we're going to talk about the Iraq debt agreement. Mike mentioned that a little bit last week. The Paris Club of Debtors, which includes countries, the countries that are owed money by Iraq. Iraq has about $120 billion in debt. It owes about $39 billion to the Paris Club of Debtors, which includes France, Germany, Britain, Japan, and Russia. Those folks agreed to forgive up to 80% of Iraq's debt that's owed to them, which means they'll be forgiving about $31 billion out of an estimated 38.9, so just about $39 billion that's owed to them. It's only a small piece of Iraq's massive $120 billion debt, though. $60 billion is owed to Arab Gulf nations and former Soviet bloc countries like Bulgaria and Romania. Now, and that leaves about $20 to $30 billion that's owed to private banks and companies. Now, that $31 billion that the Paris Club is going to forgive, it won't be all forgiven right away, though. Only about 30% is going to be forgiven immediately and unconditionally. The rest of it, there are strings attached. About $30 billion will be tied to the adoption of an IMF restructuring program sometime next year, and that's all dependent on whether or not we're going to get an elected, legitimate government in Iraq, too, that can negotiate a program with the IMF, the International Monetary Fund. And the final 20% will be contingent on the success, the implementation of that program, IMF program. Now, for folks who have paid any attention to globalization, to how the World Bank and the IMF operates, they know that the IMF usually puts conditions on its loans, like, and on its restructuring programs, like you have to cut as much of public infrastructure as possible, you need to privatize state industries, et cetera, et cetera. Usually the population gets the short end of the stick. State industries are sold off cheap to multinational corporations. Healthcare suffers, not that there is much healthcare infrastructure in Iraq right now. So it's. I think what the IMF is going to be moving towards is a way to privatize and sell off Iraq's oil industry. And that's what is going to be the main incentive for Iraq to get their debt forgiven, is to sell off their oil resources cheaply. Now, this agreement also has a little surprise inside of it. There's a clause in the agreement that gives the Paris Club the option of suspending the debt reduction plan entirely if Iraq's other creditors don't step up to the plate and write off some of the debt that Iraq owes to them. However, the Arab nations of Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, the biggest single between the two of them, the biggest creditors to Iraq, they said on Tuesday that they are not willing to forgive any of Iraq's debt until after elections and there's a legitimate government in Iraq for them to negotiate with directly. So they do not want to negotiate with Ayad Alawi, the interim prime minister, and the U.S. embassy they view as an occupier. So that could be a monkey wrench thrown into this new debt plan. So we'll watch and see. The $30 billion. The original 30% might be forgiven right away, but the rest of it may never happen. Now, we also want to talk a little bit about elections. The interim government announced a date for the elections in Iraq. They said they're going to happen, on January 30th. Now, this is in spite of the fact that some parties, even within the government, have been urging the interim government to postpone the elections, and urged again this week that they postpone the elections for 6 months for several reasons, particularly the security situation and the fact that there have been no voter registration centers open in all of Anbar province and in the city of Mosul. So about 90 of the 540 voter registration centers around the country have been closed during this period of intense voter registration, which is going to end on December 15th. And it's looking like those voter registration centers are never going to be open to register voters in the Sunni heartland. That in itself is a big step towards disenfranchising a large portion of the population, not a majority of the population. The Sunni Muslim folks in Iraq are about 20% of the population, but it's a significant minority that used to be in power. And if they are disenfranchised and they do not participate in the elections, that's a step towards civil war.
Yeah, it's a very well-defined minority also that's cohesive and that will take umbrage as a whole.
Yeah. Now, there are some other things that would argue for delaying the elections. Another one is that there are not enough Iraqi security members of the security forces to guard polling places. Certainly, U.S. troops cannot be guarding the polling places because they will make them a target of insurgent violence just by being on the premises, and they will scare away a certain number of Iraqi voters who don't want to have to go through metal detectors and U.S. troops in order to cast a vote. Now, in addition to that, there are only 10 UN staff now in the country, in Iraq, and only 25 are scheduled to be in the country in December. Now, you can compare that number to some 266 UN election workers in Afghanistan for their election. And Ukraine just had 563 international observers from the OSCE and the European Union and various other organizations to monitor their elections. Now, if you've only got 25 to 30 UN election workers in the country and no international monitors, because no organization and no country has stepped forward and said, we will volunteer folks to come in and monitor the elections. They don't want to do that because of the security situation. They don't want their people to be killed.
Yeah, it's much too dangerous.
Then there's some question about whether or not you can hold legitimate elections if there are no international election monitors and no UN staff to help out. So that's a big problem. Another one is the threat of a boycott. As of this week, all of the prominent Sunni groups in Iraq, all of them, have now said that they will boycott the elections. This includes a host of small parties, plus the Muslim Scholars Association, who are sympathetic, widely viewed as sympathetic to the insurgents, and the Iraqi Islamic Party. This is a surprise because those folks had four members in the interim government. Those four members of the government resigned when U.S. troops attacked Fallujah. They basically said, this is the wrong way to go. We are resigning from the interim government. They're the one major Sunni Muslim party that was accepted by the U.S. occupying government and allowed to participate in the interim government. Those folks have now withdrawn from the government, and now they're saying, you have to delay the elections or we're going to boycott them in January. So all of the major Sunni groups are saying that they're not going to participate. So this is clearly, if the elections go forward in January 30th, as George Bush wants them to do, and as Ayed Alawi has said that he will do, there's going to be a major problem, and it's going to be a major step down the road towards civil war. There are other things going on that are disturbing in Iraq that show some multi-ethnic fighting, some inter-ethnic fighting. The Kurdish Peshmerga fighting in Mosul have inflamed tempers in that city. It's a multi-ethnic city. There's a large population of Sunni Arab folks that live in Mosul. There's also a large number, there's a large Turkish population and a large Kurdish population. So when Kurdish troops came in with U.S. troops to help put down the uprising in Mosul, that's creating some inter-ethnic rivalries there. In addition, the roads that go south from Baghdad to the holy cities of Karbala and Najaf, those roads go through Sunni Arab territory, and there have been a lot of Sunni tribal folks who have been setting up roadblocks. There are some criminal gangs that have been raiding pilgrims going south, Shiite pilgrims going south to the holy cities, and now you've got Shiite militias organizing in Basra to go up and fight those folks. So that's an ominous indicator that there's some inter-ethnic rivalries or inter-religious rivalries going on in Iraq that weren't happening before. And part of that is, it all ties into the lack of security in Iraq, but most particularly because there are not enough Iraqi security personnel to actually make sure that those roads stay open, and the U.S. military is certainly not doing it. Right now, the U.S. military is starting a new campaign to kind of sweep through that area and try to wipe out that problem. But that's going to be almost impossible because they're dealing with tribal folks who've lived in that area for, centuries. It's not like they're foreign fighters that they can wipe out and have the problem be over with. So that concludes This Week in Iraq.
All right. Well, we did get an email.
Good.
And it said that they're on Tuesday they're going to be setting up a Fallujah at Westlake Park from 3 to 6 p.m. And so hopefully that'll be up.
Oh, that's interesting. They're going to have up information about what happened.
They're going to bomb the hell out of Westlake Park.
They're going to shred it. I guess you'll just have to go down and find out.
Maybe some street theater going on.
But that was from Mark Epstein. Thank you for sending that in.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. 3 to 6 p.m. on Tuesday, Westlake. And, well, there was some good news this week. We always try and find some good news out there, but
we don't always succeed.
No, yes. We don't. But in terms of nuclear weapons, the Bush administration has long wanted to fund new nuclear weapon development, and
they've been putting their attention on these new tactical nuclear weapons, bunker buster bombs, which they have a name for, and if the official name is Robust Nuclear Earth Penetrator, which. Sounds a little bit like a sex toy.
Sounds very phallic, yeah.
It does. The tactical battlefield weapons, nuclear battlefield weapons. Fortunately, the Congress...
I think for some of these generals, it is a sex toy.
I think so. Oh, honey, we just got the money passed for the new robust nuclear earth penetrator.
Oh, dear, you're so robust.
Oh, wow. Let's have a little fun anyway. So what happened is Congress didn't pass the money for the robust nuclear earth penetrator. And this is a surprise because the Republican-dominated Congress, you would think, would be right with the Bush administration on this. But fortunately, there are some calmer heads in the GOP that said, no, we're not going to fund this. The Bush administration had asked for $27.6 million to continue work on the bunker buster bomb, and they wanted an additional $9 million for research into these low-yield tactical nuclear weapons to be used on the battlefield. The Congress cut both of those programs, and so the Bush administration didn't get their request, which I think is something we should be celebrating.
Yeah, it's a significant victory for anti-proliferation folks, even though the Bush administration has been one long series of setbacks for anti-proliferation.
I think it sends a good message to the international community, too, that there's somebody sane in the U.S. government. Because, you know, it's really hypocritical for the U.S. to go to countries like Iran and North Korea and say you shouldn't have a nuclear program while at the same time developing nuclear weapons to be used on the battlefield. I think that's extremely hypocritical. And some folks might see it as a provocation that when you say you're going to develop new nuclear weapons to be used on the battlefield, it's something that's going to trigger countries that see themselves or that you see as your rivals. It's going to give them an incentive to develop their own nuclear programs.
Yeah. Of course, now we still have Star Wars. We still have ballistic missile defense that we have to deal with.
Yeah,
we have plenty of funding for other weapons. And quickly, last week we mentioned that there was a... incidents of mad cow scare that they were testing, and this week they got the results. They got the results they wanted.
Yeah, it was interesting. They announced that after two tests at Ames, Iowa, the test they usually use as the gold standard for determining whether or not a cow has mad cow disease, after running two of those tests, that the animal turned up negative for mad cow disease. And my first thought was, they ran the test twice?
Yeah, why two tests?
Yeah,
They've never done that before.
Yeah, did they run it until they got the results they wanted? You know? Yeah, I think there's a serious question there. What's going on? You know, and who's watching over this and regulating this? Because there is some possibility for observer error. Even though this test is considered the gold standard, it relies on an experienced person to read the results. So I think there's some question there about how the test was run and why they had to do it twice.
Particularly when you bear in mind the tremendous amount of economic interest that is riding on this, where you have an entire industry that is desperate to have a negative test result.
In fact, there's some question about that on the release of the information with the Chicago exchange there that deals with beef, that they believe that this information, all of a sudden prices shot up like a couple hours before this information was released, and they think there might have been a little inside
leak there. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So yeah, you're right, there's a lot of financial interest involved in this. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. Talking once again with John Parrish and Maria Tomchick, co-editors at Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State is a periodical newspaper that comes out every other week, put out largely by volunteers. It covers local and global politics. You can find it where you find free publications at bookstores and cafes and places like that, libraries. You can also find it on the web. Our current and past issues are all at www.eatthestate.org. And if you have questions, comments, tips, you'd like to volunteer, you'd like to donate money, we can always use that. Our voicemail is area code 206-903-9461.
And you can donate from our website.
Yes.
And we will be starting our year-end fundraiser. So this now is the best time for folks to donate.
Our pledge drive that we do twice a year.
Yeah.
Just like radio stations.